There is a battle underway in this country, a battle against invasive species. Insects, fish, animals, and plants are not native. The harm they can do and how climate plays a factor next on Jet Streaming. Hello and welcome to Jet Streaming. We are celebrating 20 weeks of talking about the weather and climatology on this podcast, produced by Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kathy Werzer, along with my co-hosts, Dr. Mark Seeley from the University of Minnesota, and Craig Edwards, the former head of the National Weather Service office in the Twin Cities. Nice to have you guys with me again.
Good day, Kathy.
Just a delight to be with you always, Kathy.
Well, just the other day, you guys, I noticed one of my plants, a vine, looked as if something had been busily munching on it, and the plant, I was shocked to find, was nearly defoliated. And after a close examination, I found this bug I've never seen before. It was a Japanese beetle, as I took it and squished it and then took it into a local nursery to find out what the heck this thing was. It's clearly a species not native to this region. And as you both know, there are more and more bugs and fish, animals, and plants that are finding their way into this country, and they're muscling out native species, and that is of great concern to scientists and others. We have two guests on this important issue. One is Jennifer Funk. She's a postdoctoral fellow in the Stanford University Biological Sciences Department and lead author of a study that looked at how exotic species can flourish even in poor conditions. Jennifer, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Dr. Dave Ragsdale. He's an entomologist at the University of Minnesota and an expert on invasive species. And Dave is nationally known for his work. Welcome to Jet Streaming, Dave.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad you're both with us here. Jennifer, I'm going to start with you first. Biologists have long figured that exotic species would have a tough time catching on in an environment that wasn't very hospitable. Native plants that flourish, even in less than ideal conditions, have what some of us thought would be the home field advantage, but your research seems to indicate something a little different.
Yeah, that's true. So typically with the home field advantage, native species are thought to have adapted to the systems, to the resource levels, whether it's the light or water or nutrient availability in the soil. And so really, people have thought that in these more human-dominated systems where we're disturbing the environment, we're sort of artificially increasing the soil nutrient availability with fertilizer, or we're increasing irrigation into an area that promotes invasive species. So in natural areas, or areas where you're actually removing some of these resources by trying to restore some of the areas, you know, one might think that this might be a way of sort of getting rid of invasive species and promoting the growth of native plants. But some of the work that I've been doing in Hawaii sort of demonstrated that that might not be the case. So we found that a lot of the invasive species that we were looking at were just as efficient at using those limiting resources compared to the native species.
That had to have been a surprise.
Yeah, it was a surprise, primarily because a lot of folks have just, I guess invasive species work in general, particularly with plants, yeah, I can't really speak to the animal component, have mostly focused on these sort of case studies. And so this is one of the first studies that has looked at a bunch of different invasive and native plants spanning different life forms from grasses to trees and shrubs to really find general patterns. So this was sort of a surprise when we put it all together.
Well, this could be for Jennifer or Dave. Mark Seeley here. I was wondering, in the context of conservation biology or ecosystem science, when do you consider, or is there a point temporally where an invasive species is no longer considered as such, but a native species? In other words, there's a transformation of the ecosystem, and after some degree of time, it's just considered native, or am I completely off base there?
Dave Ragsdale, do you want to take that first, and then Jennifer?
Sure. At least from the insect side, we often speak of this transition. We consider invasive ones, ones that become pests, and then once we deal with them for decades or longer, then we start treating them as naturalized insects. They do have start collecting natural enemies that affect them. And their populations are a bit regulated by the generalist predators and diseases that are present in the new environment. But that's a hard question to always say, put a label on something at every time. Some species never do come under control. An example would be the Japanese beetle. It's been in the country for a hundred years or more, and it continues to spread and continue to invade new areas.
Jennifer, comment on this?
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's very difficult sometimes to put a label on species, particularly with plants. You often have a lag time associated with them once they get introduced into an area. So a plant that might not appear to be invasive at first could become very problematic later. And particularly in Hawaii, plants are grouped into different categories based on whether or not they think they can be controlled. So any invasive plant that's particularly damaging, you know, might be targeted for control, where other ones just become they become part of the system, and the managers realize they cannot be controlled, but they still are considered invasive.
One of the things the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change is trying to wrestle with is the fact of the species becoming extinct. And how do you put that into perspective as a relationship to the species migrates instead of becomes extinct? Is that more likely to occur, or what do you think the situation is with the species through the climate change conditions?
Dave Ragsdale, do you want to take that first?
Oh, sure. Well, extinction in insects is not a very common phenomenon. Well, first of all, we probably only recognize 1 out of 10 species on the planet. So there's 9/10 of organisms out there that we don't even have a scientific name for. So of the pest species, though, that we're dealing with, and that's typically what we tend to notice in insects, are the more abundant, more flamboyant, more numerous species. We don't see a lot of extinction events. But it's not that it can't occur. There are threatened and endangered species, and generally that's because of habitat destruction rather than an event that occurs locally. Insects have the ability to move and to adapt, and short life cycles enable that adaptation to occur relatively quick.
Is there any way to look at how climate change factors into the spread of exotic species, both in terms of insects and plants? Has anyone looked at that to date, Jennifer?
Yeah, there actually has been some work actually by some folks at Stanford a couple of years ago, thinking about how global change is going to influence the spread of invasives. And at least with respect to some of the research that I've been doing, if you think about resource availability and how global change might affect that. So particularly in the West, we're anticipating declines in precipitation. So I guess before my study, I would have been convinced that would have favored native species, making it harder for invasive species to thrive in that very drought-stressed environment. But some of the research that I've just done now sort of put a big question mark on that for me. So maybe invasive species are able to thrive in those resource-limited environments. And especially with increased temperatures and all these other confounding factors, I think that we do need a lot more research to try to figure out how the invasive and native plants are going to respond to these variety of different factors.
And to that end, too, Dave, why are some insects, maybe even some of the exotic species of insects, why do some thrive and others do not? Does climate play an issue in that?
Well, certainly climate does play an issue in establishing any exotic species into a new area. Even when we do intentional introductions of insects in the context of biological control, we worry a great deal about, you know, where we collect the insects to the parasites or the predators to release to control species, to make sure that we do match climate. And as climate changes, and insects are established, that, you know, this isn't going to be a rapid enough change to cause extinction events, although, again, that's far afield from what I study. I think insects are mobile enough. They are able to follow their resource, whether that resource be plants or whether that resource be other organisms, and thrive in those environments. There is a study in England. They've had a trapping network called the Examine Network. It's a series of suction traps that, 70 or 80 suction traps that are operated throughout Europe and England, and they've been done so for 50 years or more. And they see tremendous species change over the last 50 years, indicating that climate is allowing insects to move northward and to begin reproduction earlier, sometimes up to a month earlier than has been seen in the past. And so there are some good evidence out there of human-driven climate change causing increase in species abundance.
I wanted to frame a context and then ask a question for both of you to consider. Jennifer, in her paper, describes the opportunity for invasive species as due to a disturbed environment, and that may be a disturbance caused by humans, maybe logging or fire, maybe damming, it may be draining, it may be any number of things, or it may be something else. It may be, I suppose, inundation from a landfall hurricane or a flood, or it may be an earthquake or some other kind of thing. But once that disturbance occurs, the invasive species has an opportunity, and referred to as sometimes overcoming the so-called home field advantage of the native species and taking over. What is our, taking this analogy a bit further, what is our success rate to date when we go in and try to get rid of these invasive species? Do we have much of a batting average, to take that analogy a bit further? Or is it a very, very poor batting average? When once an invasive species is established, does the record show that we have little success in mitigating that?
And Jennifer, why don't you take that first, and maybe how your research sheds light on that?
Okay. Well, I've always been very frustrated, actually, with the sort of little information that there is out there, especially in the academic world, about these invasive species control and restoration programs. Primarily because the results of these extensive efforts are not published in the scientific literature. So it's very hard to know what strategies different resource managers are using and how effective they are in what systems. So some of the work that I've done in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, I mean, they have a great management crew there, and they use a variety of different methods to really early detection appears to be the best method to use for controlling invasive species. So the species that they know are on the island, they know they're going to be problematic in certain areas. As long as they're vigilant about finding them, they can eradicate those species from a new infestation very quickly. But with respect to getting at some of the invasive species that have been there for decades now, their batting average really is close to zero, unfortunately. So some of the early detection methods are pretty much the best ones that are out there.
And Dave Ragsdale?
Yes. Well, if we look at just a subset of this, of invasive species, so invasive plants, and look at the attempts to use herbivores as a mechanism of control, so kind of a classical approach in biological control, importing an herbivore from another part of the planet from where the invasive species range was considered native, and releasing those into the new environment, we do have a fairly decent track record on those attempts of doing such things. Roughly one-third of the time we're successful in completely controlling. Now, Mark, it's never eliminating invasive species, but it's reducing the invasive organism to a population density that makes it non-invasive. Partial success, where it works in some habitats but not in all, has been known, but there are failures as well. So about a third of the time we're successful, a third of the time we cannot establish the herbivore, and a third of the time we have some partial effect, but the plant species is still considered invasive.
As two researchers, by the way, when you look at your respective areas of study, what really concerns you about invasive species and where we're heading? Jennifer?
Well, always the one thing that I'm very concerned about is sort of the lack of legislation, actually. I don't know if it has anything to do with research budgets or where people are directing the research questions, but you know, in Hawaii, it seems very simple to me. If the state could pass some laws preventing the importation of certain species, there wouldn't be invasive species in Hawaii. So I feel that, that really the scientists need to start communicating with policymakers to try to get a better to solve the problem. Really, that's my biggest concern.
Okay, Dave Ragsdale.
Well, and I think what we see is we're seeing more and more events of where invasive species are becoming established and are causing harm, and this is linked with this global trade. For example, the container shipments that we get from Asia, only 2% of those are inspected at any given point in time. So 98% are coming in, being transported around the country, and this is how invasive species, especially insects, hitchhike and get established. We have the emerald ash borer established in the upper Midwest, where it's lethal to ash trees, which is one of the most common trees in the northern arboreal forest. This is not an insect we're going to get rid of quickly, and it's going to cause devastating effects to the native forests. That's just one example, and these are going to become more and more and more frequent just because the ability to move things globally. We can, you know, in hours, be from, you know, central China to central U.S. and be able to affect local populations that very quickly.
One final question for the two of you. From the recent IPCC chapters that have been released over the last several months, it's quite clear that the pace of climate change is much more profound at high latitude, and by that I might say, 60 degrees and north. Loss of permafrost, loss of polar ice, more convective thunderstorm systems, higher temperatures, a number of features of the environment are changing more rapidly than elsewhere. Will that mandate that researchers such as yourselves may start concentrating field research efforts up at those high latitude positions?
Jennifer, do you want to, which I bet you'd hate to leave Hawaii.
I would hate to leave Hawaii. I mean, this is actually, it's an interesting point. This point was, I think, featured in Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, where he was talking about glaciers retreating and these new areas opening up for invasive species. And I haven't quite figured out what study he was referring to there. But the high-latitude areas typically don't have a lot of invasive species right now. They currently could, as all of this new land is forming and then the climate is changing more drastically up there. So it certainly is does have a potential for invasive species problem in the future. So it would be a very interesting area to study.
Mm. And well, Dave, are you comfortable where you are right now in terms of looking at invasive species in our area?
I have more than enough to do in our area, and I complain about driving 100 miles to my research site. So going to the 60-degree north latitude to do research is difficult. And I think I probably don't disagree with you, Mark, that it should be done. But I guess I have a big question mark. Will it be done? It'll probably be one or two mega projects that will take a look at that, but on a specific organism and a specific site, I can't imagine that being done very quickly.
Well, Dave and Jennifer, excellent information. We appreciate your time here. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks very much.
Jennifer Funk is a researcher at Stanford University. Also with us, Dave Ragsdale. He's with the University of Minnesota. Coming up, Mark takes me on a tour of the Climate Observatory on the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota.
Mr. Weatherman, why is my baby so cold? Well, I've been watching you.
Well, we are here on the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota. Professor Seeley, where are we exactly, though?
We're on the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus. We're just north of the greenhouse complex and just south of Larpenteur Avenue. We're actually right in the middle of where a lot of agricultural research is done, and that's, as you can see, manifested by all the crops that surround us. We've got corn and soybeans all around us here that they're doing research on. The name of the facility is the Climate Observatory, established in October 1960. It's part of both the national network and the global network of monitoring climate in detail. And by that I mean, Kathy, we take far more measurements here than your average everyday weather observer.
It appears that way. Now, we are kind of surrounded here by a small field of various contraptions. Explain this.
Right. Well, a lot of this has become automated in recent decades, a lot of the instrumentation, that is. We take standard hourly temperatures and dew point measurements. We make measurements of wind speed and direction. We make measurements out here of evaporation. Now, we're one of just a handful of stations in Minnesota that measure daily evaporation rates.
Oh, hang on. Well, bring me over there. Come on. Let's walk over here. I have to see this because you're pointing over here.
Yeah.
And this looks to be kind of like a little pool of water, obviously, which would be appropriate since it's an evaporation.
Right. It's a standard stainless steel tank filled with water, and it's a volumetric measurement. In reality, for listeners, we refill to a marked level every day the amount that's been evaporated. So we measure how much we have to put in there to replace what was evaporated. Now, for a summer day in Minnesota, this might amount to a quarter inch to a third of an inch, the equivalent of getting a quarter inch to a third of an inch of precipitation, for example. We would lose that in evaporation. And in a year like we've had, and much of the other parts of the country have had, where we've had drought in place, drought has been not only the result of a lack of precipitation, but it's been the result of having inflated or amplified evaporation because we've been so warm and we've had a lot of sunny days and things like that.
Now, this is not applicable, I would presume, in the wintertime.
No, it's usually taken down in October. The season for measuring evaporation generally runs from mid-April to mid-October. And then it's put away for the season. You're right, because everything would freeze up in the wintertime.
Now, attached to this particular contraption here, Mark Seeley, I see something that looks to be maybe a measurement of wind speed.
That's right. That's an anemometer.
Anemometer.
Right. It's at technically, to meet world meteorological standards, it's set at a half meter above the ground. It sits above the tank of water, and it measures the total passage of wind across the water. Now, the reason that's important is that water is emitting water vapor into the overlying atmosphere, but the rate it's emitting that water vapor is a function of the ventilation, how much wind is passing across it. So the more wind that passes across the water, the more water vapor molecules are released into the air. So it's very important to simultaneously with your evaporation tank measure wind passage across that water. And you'll find that at all places that make similar measurements.
Have you been surprised, as we're in the middle of this drought, about the rate of evaporation this summer specifically?
Well, I haven't been surprised. We've measured evaporation rates, believe it or not, out here as high as 0.4 inches per day.
Goodness.
Now, just think in your mind, if you evaporated like that, say you had a series of 90-degree days with very low humidity, lots of sun, and lots of wind, think of what you would accumulate over a week period if you were evaporating that much. To make up for that, you'd need over 2 inches of rainfall to come that week in order to balance things out. We saw that last in 1988, the great drought of 1988. It's been many summers since we've seen evaporation rates that high. So that represents an extreme end of the measurement spectrum.
Well, speaking of measurements now, we are going to turn around here. Now, this is your typical weather observation station.
That's right. You'll find temperature is taken at, I'm just guessing, probably 200 locations in Minnesota. And this is one. We have two types of enclosures for our instruments. We have what's called the old cotton region shelter because it was first pioneered in the 19th century down in the cotton growing regions of the U.S. It's a louvered wooden structure, sits at a height of about 5 feet above the ground. You'll notice the ground is sod covered. That's also a dictate of the World Meteorological Organization. You don't put these things over pavement, you put them over sod. And then inside we have an alcohol thermometer for measuring minimum temperature and a mercury thermometer for measuring maximum. Now, right next to it is the modern version of this, which you find increasingly all over the world, which is thermistor-based, electronic-based temperature measurements that are embedded in a shield, a ventilated shield that's analogous to the cotton region wooden shelter, but that's made out of plastic, inverted plastic plates, and that records electronically the maximum and minimum temperature.
So it's pretty high tech, but you know, you come over here, Mark, and I'm seeing this is decidedly low tech. I don't know what this is, but this looks like a potato strainer with a little scrubby attached to it.
Yes, yes. When you measure solar radiation with an instrument we call a pyranometer, it sometimes gets dirty. I mean, we are out here where they plow the fields, you know. They plow the fields, they harvest the crop, they do all kinds of other things that put debris in the air here. And the top of the instrument that measures incoming radiation gets a little dirty, so we have to have a mechanism to scrub it.
Now, see here, I thought the way you have it set up, it looks like it was just part of this overall machine here.
Yeah, well okay, it has a periodic functionality to it, as does this vegetable strainer. We've got a wire basket vegetable strainer because, quite frankly, the glass dome of the pyranometer, the glass that covers the instrument itself, when we're under the threat of hail, we don't want that glass to break because to replace that instrument is thousands of dollars. So somebody comes out here and takes this little vegetable strainer and puts it over the top of the instrument to protect it.
Like $125 or something like that.
That's
good.
That's right.
And every day someone comes out here to take the readings of all these different instruments?
Well, that used to be the mode. Because much of this was manually based, we had to have someone here to do it. The truth is, people are out here weekly, but not daily anymore, because we've so automated the instruments that the computer systems will just raise a red flag when they're malfunctioning, and then someone will come out here to check on things.
We should tell folks, too, that we're on kind of hallowed ground here, I suppose, as dry as it is, of course, because this little patch of Earth is been talked about on an international scale.
That's right. Those who've read the intergovernmental panel reports on climate change and read about manifestations of climate change in the Northern Hemisphere might like to know that the St. Paul Observatory is part of a Northern Hemisphere network where we measure ground temperature, deep ground temperature. It's one of a handful of locations where we can measure over the last 40 plus years the accumulated heat that's being stored in the ground. And the accumulated heat that's being stored in the ground is a measure, really, of how the Earth is warming. And these data have been published in numerous research papers in recent decades.
You have a favorite instrument here in this little observatory? I had to pick one, because we're surrounded by all kinds of different ones.
Yeah. The one that captures me out here, I guess, the most is the wind vane and anemometer. I think the first thing I look at when I come out here to check things is I check for the wind direction, what's the direction today, and what the wind speed might be. Now, I might add, too, Kathy, out here on the St. Paul campus, granted we've only been measuring since 1960, but we have measured some rather strong wind speeds out here, well over 60 miles an hour.
Oh, I believe that.
Yeah.
It's a little breezy out here this morning. It's pleasant and everything, but it's a little breezy.
And that's not just because us university professors are so windy.
Hey, thanks for the tour.
You're welcome. And by the way, the campus observatory is a public facility. We often do show the public around out here.
You know a lot about the weather scene. Give me the news. Tell me no lies. Was my baby colder than a block of ice? Got a lightning bolt.
You know, that was a lot of fun. Thanks for bringing me over there. Appreciate that, Mark.
You're welcome, Kathy.
And by the way, I think we have to make over to Craig's weather station and maybe have a refreshing beverage after tour over there. What do you think, Craig?
That'd be just delightful. I think we'll take that in someday. We'll have to do that.
Now, of course, we should tell folks, Craig was on a different line when we were talking to Jennifer Funk and Dave Ragsdale, and all of a sudden we lost him. And I had to get him back on the phone.
I was like an invasive species.
I know.
I was migrating.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Hey, by the way, we're going to wrap this thing up here pretty quick. We do have a weather-related question this week, wouldn't you know? And I think it's a good one here. Is it true that snow was once reported in August along the Lake Superior shoreline in Minnesota? Please tell me no. It is not true.
Unfortunately, it is indeed true.
Mark.
Now, we get into the month of August, and we're all thinking state fair time. We're thinking last month of the summer, a chance to get to the lake and do some fishing or water skiing. And yet, back on August 31st, 1949, at the newly constructed Duluth Airport, the National Weather Service reported snow.
Oh.
Now, of course, the ground was so warm, being August, that nothing stuck. But that's the only instance in about 200 years of history that we can find of a snowfall observation in the month of August. I'm not saying beware. This August looks hot, if anything. But it can happen.
Wouldn't you just love to go ahead and look out your window there, Craig, and see snow?
Well, that's unbelievable. They probably blamed it on the National Weather Service putting a new office in town.
Hey, before we go, how about the weather website of the week? Yes, get that thunder cracking. Actually, this site encompasses a lot of interesting research in many fields, including atmospheric science. It's actually where we discovered one of our guests this week, Jennifer Funk. It's the sciencedaily.com site. sciencedaily.com. Fascinating studies there. Very understandable, thought-provoking articles. Check it out, sciencedaily.com. Well, it is time to check out and leave cyberspace until next week. Thank you, Mark Seely.
Thank you, Kathy.
And good to have you back, Craig Edwards.
Thanks, Kathy.
I'm Kathy Werzer. If you have a question for the Jet Streaming Podcast crew, don't be shy. Drop us a line at minnesotapublicradio.org. Click on Jet Streaming and fill out the form. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.
Keep on the sunny side.